This is Law and Policy Bites, 2010. This is Mark Seltzer.
And this is Jessica Piccolo.
So I'm looking forward to talking about the Citizens United case. It seems like it has a lot of different issues and implications in it that I think are very interesting.
For those of you who may not know, Citizens United was a challenge to certain portions of the McCain-Feingold campaign finance law. And essentially, the court brought down what has been touted now as this extremely radical decision that has completely eviscerated campaign finance reform and will result in corporations spending unfettered cash directly now into political campaigns.
And it's corporations and nonprofit organizations. I think it's going to apply to organizations that might have been bound before to certain strict limits on the way that they contributed funds and participated in political speech.
That's an important clarification because unions, for example, spend a ton of money directly on political campaigns. And so they will be, to the extent this is a hamstringing decision, they'll be as equally hamstrung as traditional corporations or nonprofits.
I felt it was really interesting with this decision that Justice Roberts wrote an opinion that essentially says the First Amendment freedom of speech trumps concerns over too much corporate spending power, too much risk of corruption, because essentially the court was looking at whether the justification that there's a corruption of the process was enough to legitimize restrictions on the value of free speech. And the Roberts Court says, no, not enough. You know, we have to strictly scrutinize any kind of a restriction on free speech, whether it's a corporation, a political party, an individual, and there is not enough, the appearance of corruption or concerns about it in this case are not enough to justify that kind of restriction.
And there were a lot of restrictions that were left in place. So the majority decision is, I believe, a study in really actually taking a scalpel and a fine, you know, edge approach to this issue.
Yes, and so you're referring to the fact that it left in place the disclosures and disclaimer rules so that if a corporation, if a union is creating a campaign ad that's going to end up endorsing a candidate or an issue, that they've got to clearly have, I think they say, 4 seconds of their name and attribution being there for the public to see. 8 members of the court endorsed that. So that was one of the ringing endorsements of this decision.
And, you know, we have a couple mechanisms of how we regulate cash into campaigns to begin with. And McCain-Feingold exists on the federal level. And then we have states that regulate it as well. And the manner in which states have gone about regulating speech has not been through statutory restrictions on an corporation's ability to spend funds. They have gone about it in their enterprise statutes, so their business organization statutes, through the responsibilities and duties that the directors and officers of the corporations have to shareholders or to members, depending on how the corporation is formed. So that while this is something to be worrisome, perhaps, in terms of the ability of very large and powerful corporations to directly spend their own funds without this kind of restriction now in place, there are other ways to get at the issue of making sure our elections are more transparent and that corporate interests and those influences are more transparent, but the Constitution may and perhaps is not the appropriate manner in which to attack that.
Right. So it's interesting, the reactions, but I can see that you've digested the case and you're not in a panic about it.
I'm not in a panic about it. It's a big deal, but it never moves at anything other than a glacial pace. So while this may be an important decision and a big decision, we have the luxury of processing and really addressing it, and it is not a sky is falling thing. We already have a ton of money in politics. That's not going to change it, quite frankly.
There were panic reactions, whether it was people who just said this was devastating for the left, for the Democrats, because a lot of corporations are going to be supporting Republican candidates in the next election, or Obama taking a shot at the Supreme Court in the State of the Union address. So there was really a pretty strong reaction to this. And an article which took a little more of a nuanced view and talked about ways in which further regulation may be able to make sure that the best of what we mean by free speech occurs and the best of what we mean by disclosure and accountability comes along with that. So while there is the panic and the message that this is a really big deal that's going to dump way too much corporate money into elections.
Well, here's what will work. Transparency will work. Trey points this out in his article, and we see it in connection with the brouhaha with CBS and the Focus on the Family ad and in the anti-abortion ad. Corporations don't like that kind of transparency because it gets their customer base riled up. So CBS right now is taking a lot of heat about this ad, and we'll see if it changes policy. It may not, but it has activated a certain base to petition and fight against them on that. Whenever corporations have to make any kind of effort to show the dirt in their process, in their decision-making process, it makes them inherently more risk-averse. So the more we require them to be transparent in their dealings, whether that's through shareholder and member initiatives or through governmental regulation or some combination of both, the more we get to that aim of preventing the unnecessary linking between unfettered corporate interest and political policy.
I thought the baseline of the Tribe article was a corporation with a financial bottom line, primarily a profit-driven corporation, has a very different approach to the political messaging than a nonprofit or even a profit-making organization that's purpose is to participate in the political dialogue. And so the question might be, how do we protect shareholders and how do we make sure that a profit-driven corporation is using money in a way that's acceptable with its shareholders, or at least that its shareholders are fully aware of what the corporation is doing with its funds. And so, you know, that's very different than a political organization that is there for the purpose and is collecting funds for the purpose of participating in the political dialogue of the country.
To me, the Citizens United case makes clear the case for financial services reform, because the continuing thread between the mortgage collapse, between the bank bailouts, between now this potential for corporate funds being directly diverted into political campaigns is transparency. Had there been daylight on some of these processes, they would not have gone down the way that they did. And I think that that same lesson will be applicable to political campaigns and their ties to corporate interests.
I mean, certainly part of the real downfall, the worst part of the financial collapse, was that people were betting on institutions and derivatives and instruments that didn't have the value that people thought. Partly it was a lack of information, a lack of transparency. And the court, in this very strong endorsement for all information that people want to put out, has to become part of the political dialogue, rejecting the idea that the government should in any way be choosing who speaks, corporation versus individual versus nonprofit, or what is said, because, you know, a Michael Moore documentary that appears to be a legitimate documentary to some people, to others is just a campaign statement. And this, the Citizens United case, was based on the Hillary film. And the court said this was a campaign advocacy piece. It was not a legitimate documentary in the sense that all of its message was going in one direction. So, but the court is saying, you know, we don't want to be the ones to make those decisions. Sure, in the past they had the two-part test with 11 criteria, mm-hmm. and a court could evaluate it. But if you're trying to speak politically and you have to worry about whether a court someday will find you criminally liable because you broke, you know, you broke the rule and you were speaking in one form and not another, that's not a free speech environment. And so, you know, it's a very interesting approach to sort of throw all that criteria out and say free speech trumps.
So we've got in that regard essentially a blank slate. And the approach that I would like to see and that I hope to see is this push towards creating accountability through the legal mechanisms that we have on corporate action. Ultimately, I think that we want corporations in the political dialogue. I mean, there is nothing other than advocacy in political speech. And we know that there are corporate interests at play in our policy. Let's have some honesty about that. Let's have some transparency about that. And ironically enough, Citizens United may be the vehicle that gets us there.
What did you think? I mean, it's certainly a side issue, but let's just touch on it before we move on. The idea of the Roberts Court disregarding one of the precedent that campaign finance reform, the control of speech by corporations was a legitimate government action. And they, I think it was in the Austin case. And they overruled that case, even though it had been long, you know, long regarded, long standing. And they were attacked for that. The dissent really attacked the idea that this court was conservative and cautious and not just substituting its opinion from previous courts.
I'm not trying to be coy, but I think that there are two answers to that. I think on the one hand, you are always upset when precedent is attacked and it serves your interest to maintain that precedent. So I appreciate from an intellectual standpoint that that was the position that the minority was coming from. And I liked Justice Stevens' dissent. I did quite a bit. And I think it's interesting from an intellectual standpoint that Roberts swore up and down that he would be a non-radicalized justice, and we see this step away from precedent. But I don't know that it's necessarily a step away from precedent to the extent that it's been talked about in the mainstream media and sort of the general understanding of the decision. I think it shows his intent to be a constitutionalist first and foremost. And if you can understand that, then it doesn't seem like such a radical departure.
And you're referring to his Supreme Court nomination confirmation hearings,
right.
Where he had to tell congressional, the Senate body that he was not a radical, that he believed in stare decisis as it's called.
Right, which is code for precedents. And that's just code for I won't try to overturn Roe. I mean, you know, it's such a kabuki in the Senate confirmation hearings anyhow that those questions, I mean, there's four layers of meaning with each of those questions. So when he gets asked, are you going to respect precedent from the Democratic senator from Vermont, that means, are you going to attack Roe? So that's, I think, where people are getting very nervous about this step away. That said, based on his conservative ideology in general, I'm not surprised to see him take a position that puts constitutional law before any other sort of common law.
I think that's very well put. And as he put it, and he did a great deal to justify his decision in terms of the reach of it, to say that this is not going that far. He did say he had a conflict of laws. He had two cases that were in conflict, and he simply decided, you know, to go with one of them, that the First Amendment dictates trump the other concerns. And he was attacked for it, but I also was sympathetic to it and did not feel that it was a radical leap and really didn't buy into some of the claims about it, because we expect our justices to evaluate in light of the times. And of course, the Constitution is the guiding instrument, but that doesn't mean that a case decided 100 years ago must be followed today, you know, that they have to reinterpret the Constitution in light of the way they understand it today. And so I don't think that necessarily, he is a constitutionalist. The conservatives give a lot more credit to founding fathers than supposedly justices with contemporary attitudes, more activist justices might do. But I don't think that interpretation or the idea that once decided can never be changed, it is the same as respect for precedent.
I think that this gives us some work to do in terms of how we manage and regulate our corporations, but I don't think that means it is the constitutional Armageddon that it's been at least portrayed by some of my colleagues on the left.
You know, it's funny, going further with it, the State of the Union address, President Obama, you know, chastised the court, saying that the decision was wrongly decided, or at least that it was going to cause some unfairness in the mighty corporate power asserting influence that he didn't think was appropriate. And Alito's reaction, which was to mouth to himself something like, not true, mm-hmm. I think that's how it was reported or whatever. Mm-hmm. But I just think it's, you know, it's interesting. It was a big deal was made. I don't know how you felt about it. I didn't buy into all of that.
Well, you know, Alito's a big personality, I'll say that. And I don't think it's a big deal. I think that it's helpful for us to remember that the justices, while the body is supposed to be separate and sort of above the fray politically, it's made up of political actors. And so Justice Alito responding as an individual does not bother me at all. And I'm not surprised that he took umbrage with the president on that. I think it would be great to listen to those two hash it out. I mean, there's no love lost between the two. And I don't think that there's any secret in there from in an intellectual standpoint. I mean, they diverge considerably in terms of their approach to constitutional law. So I'd love to be a part of that debate. But, you know, the idea that this was, A, maybe a not appropriate forum for the president to take the Supreme Court to task, I think, is also wrong. It's a policy forum, and the court's setting policy in its decision-making. So that's the opportunity for the president to address that body. And for his response, well, you know, he showed bias. And I think that that is, again, towards this idea of transparency. And it's like when you're shocked to find out your parents kiss each other. We know that they are political people, right? So why are we pretending now that this is somehow a bad thing? I mean, the court is a political body to some extent because it's involved in policymaking.
I think it's interesting because it's a forum where all three branches of government are together, and that's a rare moment in, you know, in each year that they're all in the same house. And then it's interesting because we know of the justices through their Supreme Court nominations asserting that they can't reveal their opinion or that they don't have an opinion yet on many of the cases that they're challenged, they're asked about during the confirmation hearing. And they're doing that to preserve their independence and their open-mindedness for when the case comes to them. So they can decide a case fairly on the facts of that case for that individual or that corporation that's in that lawsuit, rather than having a predisposition towards an opinion. But that doesn't mean that when they're in that chamber, when they're anywhere else, on a case they've already decided, it doesn't mean they can't have a reaction to that case or speak about that case once decided. I think that maybe raises some questions people haven't thought through. Mm-hmm. Also, the Supreme Court is a very independent body. They are appointed for life. Mm-hmm. And so we're not so concerned that President Obama, you know, chastising the Supreme Court or the public or anybody else saying anything, a congressional leader. The Supreme Court individuals have the independence. They're not going to be pushed around by anybody at this point.
Folks would have been equally outraged had a president gone out of his or her way to applaud a particular decision that was just before the court and say, you guys really did a bang-up job on that one and got it right. I mean, this is a substantial policy debate that is going on in our country, and we want the branches of government to be talking to each other about this and to disagree about it and to hash out something, because that is the process of democracy.
Well, I think that's great. We probably covered it there. That's all for Law and Policy Bites 2010 this round. Thanks, Jessica. I'll talk to you next week.
Thanks, Mark. Sounds good.